Welcome back to the program. My guest this morning, James Conaway, has been on this program a number of times before, talking about his bestsellers, Napa, The Story of an American Eden, and its sequel, The Far Side of Eden. He joins us today to talk about his new novel, set against the backdrop of Napa. It is my pleasure to welcome James Conaway back to the program to talk about Nose, a novel. James, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be back, Jeff. Thank you.
Good to have you here. First of all, a novel set against the backdrop of Napa. Talk a little bit about what you wanted to do here. I mean, you've written extensively about this area in your two very successful bestsellers. Talk about the decision to write a novel set against it.
Well, it was interesting. I didn't actually make a conscious decision to do that. I spent a lot of time, as you know, since I've talked to you about this, working on those first two nonfiction books, and over the course of writing them, I often thought, well, wouldn't it be nice to write a story set in a similar place that where you didn't have the strictures of having to actually have somebody say something or to use some facts that you couldn't prove? And anyway, I think this must have been germinating away, because one day I was actually in Napa Valley staying with friends, and I got up one morning in the guest cottage, sat out with my little computer, and this novel just started coming out. So it's, part of it was, I think, a desire to, explore what it would be like for someone who had a really extraordinary nose, so sensitive, and his fame so great because of this. I started wondering to myself, how does this affect his personal life and the people he's close to and the way he views the world? And that really was the essence of the birth of this wine critic whose name is Clyde Craven Jones. He's a Brit who's moved to California. And his one of his famous tastings includes a wine that is unidentified, and he is an obsessive sort, as wine tasters often are, and is determined to find out whose wine this is because it's extraordinarily good. And that's kind of the backbone of the book.
One of the things that happens always in a book like this is people reading it will look at it and wonder, who is that modeled after? Who is that supposed to be? What restaurant is that supposed to be? Talk about that and the degree to which you thought about that as you were writing those.
Well, I definitely drew on my knowledge. I think, I actually think romans à clé, you know, novels that are based on actual people, have a kind of inherent weakness, because the writer is then bound by trying to actually reproduce this person and imagine what a real person might be like. And I think you make much stronger characters by entirely creating something, but you do, of course, draw on your own experience as a writer. You know, Clyde Craven Jones is not a real person. Neither is Jerome Hutt, the overbearing industrial real estate type who starts a vanity vineyard, and all the other characters too are in fact complete creations. But I drew on what I knew of the wine world. Also, one of the characters, Les Breeden, is a failed journalist who turns himself into a wine critic without really having the background or the ability. And, you know, I would have, undoubtedly, some of my own experience is built into that character. He's much younger than I am, though, and he's much more adventurous. He gets involved with the wife of Clyde Craven Jones, and suddenly it's a very complicated wine country mess, but it's a pretty interesting one, I think.
One of the things that you deal with, and it's certainly very much a part of the culture, is that balance between looking at wine in terms of its quality, in terms of it as a product, as an art in many respects, and of course the mystique and culture that surrounds it, and the way those two things continually play off each other.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, that's the fascination of wine, isn't it, really? It's such an infinitely varied subject, and both physically and the way you look at it, but also historically. And wine is, I've thought about this as in the abstract, wine is an accelerant. That's what I think of it as. It speeds things up. Speeds up our good moods, at least in the beginning when we're drinking it, and it speeds up, if you're making the right sort, it speeds up your bank balance, and it also can speed up your acceptance in society as such, in your social contacts, in your ambitions. It can speed up your knowledge of the world, because wine, if you're in it in the right way, you meet a lot of fascinating people who are drawn to it, sort of for its mystery and its varied, its almost infinite variety. And in a way, fiction is better, I find anyway, form of dealing with that as a writer. It's, fiction is in some ways easier because you're not having to interview people. You're not having to write all this down. On the other hand, you have to create real people. This, you know, you can know something about wine or know something about racehorses or cars or high finance, but that doesn't mean you can write a novel about it. A novel really has to be more than just the milieu that it's set in. It has to have real people, and the reader has to feel that these people are challenged and that they deal with it, the reader has to be caught up in their struggles and believe in it. So that was the trick, really. I had the wine country is a great place to set most anything, but for it to work, the characters, I think, have to be real.
And in that sense, talk about the work that you had done on Napa, The Story of an American Eden and The Far Side of Eden, and how that shaped your view as you started to write these characters and really get to the heart of what goes on in Napa.
Well, I think what shaped my view really is maybe a broader thing that's harder to quantify. It's the way a writer looks at the world and what has shaped him or her during the course of a lifetime. I think that, and what I happen to see is, or what any writer sees, is the basic conflicts, you know, in the human animal. And so I no doubt have brought that to the wine world. I am a Southerner. Some of the listeners can tell, I guess, my voice. One of the things that struck me most about Napa, and one of the things that still strikes me, is this is going to sound odd, but some of it is very Southern in the sense that older families, established agrarian families, had a lot of sway there in the beginning. Some of them still do. They have different ideas about the way the world works, different politics. And when I first came to Napa back in the 80s, I thought this reminds me of parts of the South, these old families, established families, and they believe in what they're doing, and the fealty among them is very strong, as it is in the South, and you're either a believer in the cause and what's happening there, or you're a traitor, and there's nothing in between. Well, that's very Southern, too, actually. So I've always been interested in land as kind of a determinant in human activity, and boy, there are a few places in America today where land is more of a determinant than it is in a place like Napa or in Sonoma, and you know, there are other places that all are similar to the valley of the Catarina River, which is the setting for Nose.
One of the things that struck me as well is that as a journalist, when you're writing about Napa, or writing about anything for that matter, but certainly in the context of what you've written about, you're looking at it almost with the eye of a critic. And it's not dissimilar in some respects from the way the wine critic looks at a bottle and tastes a bottle and smells a bottle of wine.
That's an interesting analogy. I never thought about that. In other words, it's true, you're taking it apart in a way, and you're reducing it, trying to reduce it to components. Yeah, that's true. The difference is, I guess, that in dealing with human beings, human beings are even more difficult to analyze, I think, than wine is. But you definitely have a prejudice. It's true. As a writer, you have I've happened to like, you know, sort of classically structured Cabernets, not too alcoholic, a little leaner. That's kind of my style, not the big jammy fruit bombs. That isn't my style. And I probably have the same, I'm just sort of thinking about this, trying to answer your question. It's true how you, what you respond to most. And some of the characters, in my book, come to think of it, there's a vintner who's an environmentalist and kind of a renegade, a little bit of a maverick, and that actually is the sort of wine he makes. His name is Cotton Harrell, and the people, you know, the real estate figure I just mentioned, he makes this big over the top, very expensive Cabernet, spends a lot of money on it, and there's a little kind of a war, kind of a tacit war that's going on between his wine, which is called Copernicus, and this other fellow's wine, which is made in an entirely different style, but it's quite good, very good, it turns out. It's named Puddle Jump. So, you know, there are these two. You see right there the sort of grandiosity on one side and the very much down-home a reflection of what is, you know, the real appeal, I think, of Napa and places like it in California. They started out as family farms, and they have become, in many cases, the kind of ultimate expression of the American family farm. It might seem a funny way to look at some of these big multi-million-dollar organizations that are making fabulous wine, but that really is what they are. They're making the most valuable legal, growing the most valuable legal crop, or one of them, in the United States, in the world, I guess. And it has created outsized institutions, outsized wine sometimes, and definitely outsized people.
And one of the other aspects of it is the degree to which there is an element of art in the process, because that really comes out through the whole process of there being critics, as there are for movies, as there are for literature, as there are for any kind of art form, and the varying degrees of influence that critics have in that process.
Yes, that's a good point. Wine writing can sort of go from the sublime to the ridiculous, often leaning toward the latter, but it's really important, and somebody made a decision back in the 80s, or early 80s, late 70s, that wine, that just writing about wine was not enough. One had to provide numbers so people could buy it and feel, could easily grasp the idea of what a good wine was supposed to be, and use the numbers on the rating scales as a way of purchasing and determining how much they were going to spend. I think that really had a bad effect on, it hasn't had a totally bad effect, because it's made a lot of people, including vintners, a lot of money, but it's a pretty, I think it's a flawed way to look at wine. I've never really believed that a 100-point scale is anything other than an absurdity. You can't, how many wines have you seen lately that are rated 47? I mean, it's really all about wines between 80 and 100, and mostly it's about wines between 90 and 100. But that was the easiest way to do it. It made the reputation of Robert Parker and later of the Wine Spectator, and it sort of pushed writing in another direction. Most wine writing, particularly critics, well-established critics, they're not necessarily very good writers, and nor do they have to be, because they know what they're doing. On the other hand, people feel some of the mystery of wine and some of the allure of it that is beyond numbers, you need words too. So there's room in that now very crowded landscape of wine writing for most everybody. I think the most refreshing thing that's happened since I've been involved in wine is the rise of the wine bloggers. People, they were dismissed at first, but they're not dismissed anymore. There are a lot of them, and they bring different points of view to it, and a lot of a really broad spectrum of experience and knowledge, and a quirkiness that the wine, you know, established wine criticism lacks. So I think it's been a good democratizing process, all these wine bloggers, although I don't claim to be able to keep up with them all.
The irony of it, I suppose, is that in many ways the bloggers, in adding back the quirkiness, as you're talking about, have helped enhance, I would argue, some of the mystery and some of the allure that things like simple numbers, an 87 versus a 92, that simple numbers take away in many ways that mystery.
Oh, yes, I absolutely agree. And they've also forced the established critics to pay maybe a little closer attention to things. But the wine bloggers have... I agree with you. They've sort of returned. They returned a little of the mystery and acknowledged the variety here, and either explicitly or implicitly stated that or proved that you can't. That wine is not really that easy a subject. I think a little more attention could be paid still to the consequences of fine wine on the society itself. A little more attention could be paid in the blogs and the mainstream critics to the effect that really high prices have beyond just on the marketplace, what they do to the land, what it does to society, what it does to the desire of established places to expand and expand and expand so that wineries become something else. You know, that's still, I think, a slightly underreported side of the industry. But it's all a lot even more interesting than it was in the very beginning when I got into it, and still a worthy subject.
Is it your sense that all of these wine bloggers and all this new writing about wine will have the impact, ultimately, of making people like your character, like Clyde Craven Jones, who looks at it and rates things just by the number to a certain extent, that will make that go into descendancy after a while?
Well, I think that the numbers chart, the way of doing wine by the numbers, is already suffering some lack of loss of popularity. I think people are already beginning to realize that this is a pretty inadequate way of approaching it. What the future holds there, I don't really know. It's selling things by the numbers is so handy, and it's so profitable for the people who sell it that it's hard to imagine that would be totally abandoned. But there has to be some way of rating wines. I'm not convinced that the numbers is the best way to do it. If you're trying to deal with the entire universe of wine, I don't know. Maybe wine publications should stop doing that in terms of trying to take a critical look at every wine. And a lot of wine publications don't do that. You know, the wine enthusiast manages to have good writing about all aspects of the wine world and that are not promotional as they are in some of the glossy magazines. And I think that really is the best way to go after the subject because... And then, of course, there's fiction, you know, which is what I seem to have turned to now. I'm working on a prequel to this, to Nose, that is set in the late 70s, right when things really took off after the Paris tasting in California. Clyde Craven Jones, this critic I mentioned, who's close to obese in the current book, he's a young, good-looking guy who comes to Northern California to escape a bad love affair in London and encounters an old established family and gets involved there. So I think it's a way now I'm sort of going back and looking at it a little bit historically through, been exploring it through fiction, and it's quite fun, actually.
Is there any more nonfiction in the pipeline about the wine business in Napa?
Well, I've always wanted to do volume 3 of, you know, this Napa and this Far Side of Eden, those two books, and there's about 10 or 11 years between those and 12 years, I guess. And about that time has passed, about passed now between then and the last one I did, but, well, I mean, between now, but I don't know, I may do that, but what I have been sort of collecting string, as they say, for some couple of years, several years, but I, whether or not I'm going to push through and do that, I can't really say. However, what I learn and what I think about it will, it's going to show up one way or another, either in volume 3 or through this, or through fiction that I'm doing at the very moment.
James Conaway, Nose is his novel. James, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.